Our guest today on Meet the Press is one of the foremost international authorities on oil, Walter J. Levy. Mr. Levy, an economist, is an independent advisor to some of the most important governments, including the U.S. government, and some of the most important oil companies in the world. We'll have the first questions now from Robert Goralski of NBC News.
Mr. Levy, I suspect the question uppermost in the minds of most Americans, and indeed people around the world, is how long will the energy crisis last? What is your forecast?
Mr. Goralski, I believe nobody can predict it, because it depends first and foremost on the duration of the boycott of the Arab countries. And that in turn is related to the settlement of the Israeli-Arab war. So you ask me really a question, what are the chances of a settlement that will be acceptable to the Arab countries, including, of course, perhaps now first and foremost, Saudi Arabia?
Well, as long as 2.5 years ago, you were predicting an energy crisis, and now you're mentioning the Arab boycott, or the embargo, rather. Now, even if we didn't have an Arab embargo, wouldn't we still have a problem?
We would have a problem of substantial size, but which would have become a problem over time. It wouldn't have hit us as sudden as the present events have, in fact, harmed the economy of most of the important importing countries, oil importing countries of the world. We were moving towards a situation where the available supplies of oil in our own country were becoming insufficient to cover our demand, where there were still very substantial supplies in the Middle East. But when I mentioned 2.5 years ago that we are approaching a severe problem, it was related to the developing situation that oil was becoming, in fact, an instrument of economic policy, and that production of oil in the Middle East, which was physically available, was in fact restrained by action of producing countries.
How long can the industrialized states of the West, the United States, Western Europe, and Japan, get along without Arab oil?
Well, you must make a distinction between our position in the U.S. and that of Europe and Japan. If you postulate now that there will be no Arab oil, our country could in some form or fashion handle its affairs not without sacrifices, not without severe losses, but we could handle it. Neither Europe nor Japan are in a position to maintain their economic activities on any acceptable level without the availability of that oil.
Thank you, gentlemen. We'll be back to introduce our other panel members and continue the questions in just a minute. But first, this message.
Few Americans have ever seen a really big oil tanker called a supertanker. They are the most economical way to move oil across water. Many industrial countries are taking advantage of supertankers, but not the United States. America does not have a single oil terminal in a port where the water is deep enough to handle a supertanker. But here's a solution to the problem. That buoy is a deep water berth, 2 miles from shore. It's a special kind developed by Exxon. A tanker ties up to it, pumps its cargo to a pipeline buried in the seafloor, and the line takes the oil to storage tanks, which may be miles inland. This deep water berth is located off the coast of Okinawa. There are 100 others similar to it used by oil companies around the world. And they make a lot of sense. Because when you can't take the tanker to the port, they let you take the port to the tanker. Exxon, we'd like you to know.
Now, back to Meet the Press, an unrehearsed press conference. Here's our moderator, Bill Monroe.
We're ready now to resume our interview on Meet the Press. Our guest is one of the world's leading authorities on oil, Walter J. Levy. You've just met Robert Goralski of NBC News. The other questioners on our panel today are Robert Novak of the Chicago Sun-Times, Marilyn Berger of the Washington Post, and Henry Brandon of the London Sunday Times. Lawrence Spivak, regular member of the Meet the Press panel, will be back in 2 weeks. We'll continue the questions now with Mr. Novak.
Mr. Levy, in order to prevent this crisis from turning into a catastrophe, do you think it's incumbent upon the United States to become less the overt ally of Israel and more the even-handed mediator in the Middle East?
I believe it is incumbent upon the United States to try its utmost to secure peace in the Middle East. I would assume that this is not only in the interest of the two parties that are at war, several parties that are at war, it is also of interest to our own country and to all other countries. Whether you call the policy even-handed, lopsided, or whatever name you give, what is important is the result. And the result must mean peace. I believe that is at issue.
Let me rephrase the question, if I can. Do you think that if the United States continues down the road as a supplier of arms to Israel without a condition of peace, this turbulence and threats and indeed action from the Arab states will continue?
I believe if we have no peace in the Middle East, the turbulence will continue. If, however, you must also take into account if the U.S. would stop supplying arms and the Soviet continue to supply arms, we might see a Soviet takeover of large parts of the Middle East. And secondly, there is a problem that even if peace should occur tomorrow, I doubt very much that the Arab countries, from what they consider their legitimate self-interest, even though we may differ with that, would produce all the quantities that our country, and especially Europe and Japan, would have to obtain from them in order to fuel their economy.
Now, a very high official in the Nixon administration who is a policymaker in this area has told me that he feels King Faisal of Saudi Arabia at the last minute would prevent any serious economic harm from being done to this country because he is at heart a friend of the United States. Considering your expert knowledge of Middle Eastern politics, do you think that that is a realistic judgment?
You ask me really a psychological question. I would say there is no doubt that King Faisal has been a good friend of the United States. There is no doubt that King Faisal, having reached nearly the biblical age of 70 years, would like to see, before he passes away, I assume, Jerusalem, the old part of Jerusalem, under Muslim control. And I don't know how the friendship with the United States and how his religious belief would be balanced in the end. What would prevail?
Ms. Berger?
To follow that up, Mr. Levy, do you think that King Faisal would agree to stop limiting the oil if first steps were taken toward a settlement, or do you think he will really wait, as he has said, until Jerusalem and the Muslim holy places are returned to Muslim control?
I would hope that the boycott would be eased as progress is made towards peace, because obviously the peace negotiations, when and if they take place, will take time. I would think it is part of the diplomatic skill of our president and the State Department to hopefully achieve a situation where the boycott would be eased. On the other hand, you have a great deal of suspicion on the Arab side. They feel they are on to a good thing now. Most of the rulers of Europe, most of the big corporate executives, if you want to, prostrate themselves in the courts of the kings and sheikhs right now, paying their tributes. This is a very dangerous situation in terms of where to stop.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that. The Secretary of State is about to go to Europe. What would you advise him to try to get the Europeans to do in the face of this boycott, where they're taking one country and saying, we'll cut yours off now, we'll cut someone else's off later? What I think I'm asking is, are the industrialized nations pitiful, helpless giants?
I believe as long as all industrialized nations are only concerned about their own fate, try to save themselves, if necessary, at the expense of other industrialized, and for that matter, developing countries, they are in fact helpless giants, and they will find that in the end, they will not have helped themselves either. So, at the same time, as you know, there is now a boycott against Holland, a member of the common market. And the real question in front of the common market is, will it break all the rules, all the advance that the common market has made because the Sheikh of Kuwait or an Arab king has told them, please stop shipping oil to Holland? They would have resented any request like that from the Soviet Union. Beyond doubt, will they accept it from the Sheikh of Kuwait?
Are they doing anything? Have they taken any steps to help the Netherlands at this point?
If they have taken steps up to now, they have not announced them publicly.
That's why I'm asking.
They have not announced any steps publicly.
Mr. Brandon?
There has been a great deal of criticism here of the European allies because they dissociated themselves from the United States during this crisis. And I wonder, what do you think could they have done, and what would have happened if they had not dissociated themselves?
I believe this disassociation really falls into several parts. There was, first of all, the problem during the war itself of allowing bases to be used and shipments to be made from these countries. And they may well have argued, as long as it was not necessary to get involved, the overall problem for all of the countries of the Western world was easier the less involved they became, as long as the situation didn't get out of hand. There's a second problem of a reasonably coordinated approach to this very difficult oil problem that, as Mr. Goralski indicated, existed before this present Israeli-Arab war, not as dramatic as it is now, but it existed and was building up. I think there we are all to blame in not having agreed on a coordinated posture to cope with a problem which we knew were coming. Or if we didn't know, we should have known. And it is a problem not only of oil, but a problem of huge funds floating around which reach dimensions which appear to be unmanageable for the monetary systems of the world.
Well, if you look back over the period before the crisis, what you really are saying is that oil policy is too important to be left to oil executives and maybe even to individual governments, and that there should be a coordinated action either in the name of the Atlantic Alliance or the European Economic Market. Is this what you mean?
Certainly the last 3 years have shown that oil companies that have huge operations in the Middle East, who discovered this oil, who developed it, exported it all over the world, have lost practically all their bargaining power with regards to the Middle East producing countries. We have a story in the last 3 years of nothing but broken agreements between oil companies and oil producing countries. And where, when the country concerned, the producing country concerned, changed its demands, increased its requirements for money, for control, against arrangements just concluded, the oil companies could never afford to say, we want to negotiate, we want to change it, because the usual reply of the producing country was, if you do not quote-unquote agree today, we will legislate tomorrow. And a minute before the legislation became due, the oil companies, just in order to protect whatever they still had, said, yes, sir.
Mr. Growski?
Mr. Levy, a minute ago you talked about the diffusion of international responsibility for the crisis, but what about in this country? We have alternative means of energy, and yet we did not develop these means despite the fact that most people forecast this problem arising. Who is to blame for the situation the United States finds itself in today?
Mr. Goralski, one could, if one wanted to, name probably many parties that are to blame, quote unquote. I think very little purpose would be served in looking for culprits in the past if it is not helpful to resolve the problems of the future. Now, let me add one further thought to it. As long as current supply and demand of oil in this country was in reasonable balance, even though reserves were being drawn down, even though one could foresee that 5 or 8 years from now there would be grave problems in covering demand, the price system, as long as supply and demand are in balance, was not conducive to develop much more expensive oil resources from new shale, tar sands, Arctic regions offshore, and didn't encourage it. So it would have required at that time very substantial governmental measures and support. And it is very difficult for private corporations, for governments, to act in such anticipatory fashion.
Well, President Nixon, as you know, Mr. Levy, has called for self-sufficiency in energy in this country in the years ahead. Do you think that's practical? Can we achieve self-sufficiency?
I'm convinced we can achieve it. We are very fortunate because we have substantial, huge resources of fossil fuels. We have the technical means to handle it. We have still very large oil and gas resources which could be found. Alaska is now just becoming a factor after the roadblock that existed in terms of building the pipeline has been removed. I'm convinced that within 7, 8, 9 years, our country can be fundamentally self-sufficient in oil. That does not solve the problem of the rest of the world.
Mr. Novak.
Following up Mr. Goralski's question, President Nixon is talking about a program intended to make the country self-sufficient by 1980. Do you think specifically that President Nixon's program is adequate to that goal?
I would hope that the program will become perhaps intensified as time goes on. We may well have to have an approach such as the Manhattan Project in order to carry it out once it gets going. Of course, the immediate problem is a very different one. The immediate problem is to get over this winter.
But on the long-term program, sir, President Nixon continually stresses the need to deregulate the price of natural gas in order to encourage exploration, while the Democrats, particularly Senator Jackson, flatly oppose that. Do you think a deregulation of natural gas and higher natural gas prices for the consumer is essential?
I would think that in order to find large new resources of natural gas, either offshore or in the Arctic, Prudhoe Bay, and to bring it to the consumer would necessarily involve substantially higher gas prices.
And deregulation by the federal government?
Probably deregulation, but it doesn't necessarily have to include old gas. May I make the point here at the same time that while we have a very severe gas problem, we are still burning under boilers more than half of our total natural gas.
Ms. Berger?
Mr. Levy, in the immediate crisis, do you think the United States should take the lead and show a certain amount of cooperation by sharing its energy resources, which it has much more of than the Europeans and the Japanese at this point?
I believe that probably certain gestures, and perhaps more than gestures, would be exceedingly helpful to restore a certain sense of cohesion and unity among the Allies, even if in fact they have not asked for it. This problem comes up in connection with Holland. It comes up in connection with Japan. And let me add that I believe all the countries that have presently been exempted from the Arab embargo, I'm convinced, will find, if the embargo continues, will find themselves short of oil by January or February, and the lesson they may learn may well be the most useful lesson, namely that you stick with your allies rather than fight them.
Could you be more specific about what sort of gestures there should be? And if there was this kind of cohesion, would this not strengthen the position of the United States in acting as a go-between in the Mideast negotiations?
Well, of course, we are in the middle of a very excited and dynamic situation, where when our Secretary of State makes certain statements on perhaps the need for the U.S. to review its position on oil, we find statements by the Saudi Arab petroleum minister that they may cut to 20%. I think one of the most important things at this moment is not to try to increase the rhetorics and perhaps act, what would I say, in a deliberate but not necessarily publicized manner.
Mr. Brandon?
The Secretary of State, Dr. Kissinger, hinted at his last press conference at the possibility of retaliatory action toward the oil-producing countries, and I was wondering whether you think there are such actions possible or feasible.
I believe that the most important interest of the oil, of the major oil-producing countries, must be to be on reasonable terms of friendship with the Western nations and not become dependent on the Soviet Union. And I believe a second point is essential, which comes out of this crisis, namely that oil is an international raw material which is vested with international responsibilities, that it is impossible to assume that from now on we have a shared power, the oil power of one or two Arab countries, which could completely control the fate of the remaining countries of the world in whatever way they want to, that there will be a new group of satellites, not Soviet satellites, not U.S. satellites, but Arab satellites. It's impossible to conceive. And the world, together with the producing countries, has to try to establish means and measures to see to it that the resource is administered in a manner that assures equal, fair, and equitable access of all countries.
Have you any more detailed ideas of how this could be done to prevent a stranglehold of the Arab world on the rest of the world?
I believe the most important aspect of that is that the Arab countries do not want to cut off the West and destroy it.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but our time is up. Thank you, Mr. Levy, for being with us today on Meet the Press. We'll be back with you in just a minute after this message.
Recently, the airbag got its first real-life trial on a Los Angeles freeway. This film was taken moments after the crash. I'm happy to report the airbag completely prevented injury to the front seat passenger. I'm Ed Reimers for Allstate. This is the car involved in the crash, one of hundreds of similar cars the U.S. government is now using for on-road testing of airbags. The damage? Over $1,000. And this is the man involved, Howard K. Shaper. No injuries, Howard?
No, I seem to be all right, Ed.
Do you have any idea of what would have happened to you if you hadn't had the airbag?
I think I would have gone into the windshield.
Now, you wear glasses, Howard. Was there any injury or problem from the airbag?
I noticed a smudge on my glasses, but my glasses didn't even come off.
The airbag. Everyday experience on the road is helping to determine its reliability in saving lives and preventing serious injuries. Ed Reimers reporting for Allstate.
For a printed copy of today's interview, send 10 cents in coin and a stamp, self-addressed envelope to Merkle Press, Box 2111, Washington, D.C., 20013.
Next Sunday on Meet the Press, our guest will be another headline figure in the news. Now this is Bill Monroe saying goodbye for Walter Levy and Meet the Press.
Today's edition of Meet the Press was brought to you by Allstate Insurance Companies. For insurance to protect your car, your home, your life, health, and business too, talk to the Good Hands people. President Nixon will announce tonight what he has described as tough, strong action to meet the current energy crisis. He will address the nation tonight at 7 Eastern, 6 Central, and 4 Pacific Time, right here on NBC. This is Lee Dayton speaking.